Blog Talk Radio.
Well, here we go, ladies and gentlemen, across the country and the world. This is the show that keeps on going consistently every Saturday. It is hosted by a brother, a friend, and a mentor to me, Dr. Greg Roscoe in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Yours truly, Mark Mancini in Los Angeles, producing 347-205-9631. It goes by quick. Catch the archive version. blogtalkradio.com/Mancini Sports Podcast Platforms, where we subscribe to podcast powered now by Mancini Media. So without further ado, more of him, less of me. Let me lay the red carpet down, put the podium in its place, hand off the mic. Dr. Threes, how are you? How can people get a hold of you? And you're bringing this guest back. Man, oh man, I am going to man the boards and see you in about 28 minutes with the questions and comments from the listeners.
Wow. You're all revved up this morning, Mark, but thank you very much. Things are good. Our show is going well. You know, I receive a lot of emails through the week, as well as I'll get several during the show, which is very interesting, and shows me there's a lot of people that have interest in what we're talking about. People can get a hold of me, GJRMD308@outlook.com. You know, today in our series now of talking about cancers of different organ systems, today we're going to talk about the lung. And again, there's a variety of different cancers that can occur within the lung. We're going to talk a little bit about what's causing these. And, you know, we have a very special guest. We have a cardiothoracic surgeon, however, has a very extensive resume. Rod, you know, your resume is pages and pages and pages of things that he's done, where he has trained, articles he has written, chapters he has written. So he really is an expert in this field. And, you know, I bring up the topic today, cancer of the lung. And, again, just a little bit of an introduction. As far as our research that we did do, as current as 2021, there's approximately about 1.8 million deaths per year due to lung cancer worldwide. If we just go ahead and concentrate on the USA, the number is probably about 250,000 new cases of lung cancer a year, and about 130 to 150 deaths per year. And, you know, as far as that's a big number. And, you know, it started keeping track of these things many years ago. But in the 50s, lung cancer was the most common cause of death in men. As we got into the 80s and 90s, lung cancer became a leading cause of death in women. And, you know, overall, lung cancer causes more death than breast, prostate, colorectal, and brain cancer combined. But Dr. Lander, now, does that kind of set the stage for what we're going to talk about today?
Yeah, I think that needs to be really emphasized as the occurrence of lung cancer in the country worldwide, and recognize that another parsing of those facts is that one in four cancers in the United States today are lung cancers. And
wow.
Of the one in four cancers, and of the cancers you described, lung cancer is the most lethal of all cancers in the country.
And, you know, with regard to lung cancer, I mean, I think we use the word, if we define this for our listeners, we are talking about a cancer of the airway or the breathing tube, as well as the lung tissue itself. Is that a correct estimation of what this is about, Dr. Landrenau?
Yes.
And, you know, we have different cancers in different anatomical areas. You know, we have different cell types, plus we have different symptoms of these cancers, depending on where they are located. And, you know, with regard to your experience, you've probably seen it all and probably many cases of everything. And, you know, we think, and again, you can clarify that for me, we think that smoking is the big factor here, as well as going on to the next stage of this, and that's vaping. Is that where this cause comes from, based on those kind of activities people do?
Well, it says certainly smoking, direct smoking of tobacco products that contain nicotine, the addictive part of the substance, accounts for 90% of cancer, lung cancers in the country. 90% of people that will develop lung cancer have a smoking history, significant smoking, usually over 20 years of smoking. The vape issue is it really doesn't have a cancer related risk, and I think if you think deeply and not so, then you don't think that deeply, is it why is so much negativity about vaping? And it's because of the market share issue. I mean, you know, the cigarette companies don't want to lose their market share, so a lot of the negativity comes from that. Second thing is it's a lead off or a gateway towards smoking in the young. And so that's the big issue of vape. The interstitial or benign lung disease issue is really not a giant threat. And I think more than anything, it's just a marketing strategy by the tobacco companies to put just negativity on vaping. I'm not saying you should vape the nicotine,
sure.
But I'm saying it's a better alternative. In fact, in my practice, patients with lung cancer coming in that are smoking, I convert them to vapes because their habituation with nicotine is satisfied, but the carcinogens and the bronchitis affecting agents of the smoke cars is eliminated and allows them to go into their surgery with healthier lungs.
Wow.
So, that's an aside, total aside.
Sure.
I'll stop there.
No, well, you know, that's a very good point. You know, ideally, you know, if one is a smoker, ideally the best thing we could do is get them to stop, correct, as practitioners. Because, Rod,
sure.
I'll see that as well with cancer of the voice box. You know, people that smoke, you know, let's get you off the cigarettes. Let's try to get this whole upper airway healthy. Let's get you to stop. But that's the real challenge, isn't it?
It is, and I'll say that I've got a success rate of about 90-95% of getting people into their surgeries for lung cancer without smoking cigarettes because I use, you know, I help them with sedatives such as Valium, et cetera, or Ativan. Plus, I recommend a vape or some nicotine substitution. Some of my good friends here in town are the little hippies with their vape shops running around here. They know me quite well because I refer so many people to them. But that's, again, this is another issue, and maybe
sure.
a little bit off topic. But I think
I know what you're saying. And again, as far as that's a very interesting situation that, you know, I didn't have on the agenda today. You know, getting them on vaping versus smoking. But, you know, as far as if I can get back on topic a little bit, you know, we talk about lung cancer being of the airway or of the lung parenchyma. There are several different cell type cancers in the lung that you see. Is that correct, Rodney?
Yes, correct. There's two main subdivisions based upon the direction of therapy. And they're named very simply by what they look like under a microscope, and that is either small cells or bigger cells or non-small cell lung cancer. So
sure.
We have two primary varieties. Small cell, which is primarily a disease that's treated with systemic therapy, chemotherapy, immunotherapy, with sometimes the addition of radiation therapy. And then non-small cell cancer, which has a variety of therapies based upon the stage or the extent of the disease. So with disease
sure.
that's small and not involved in the lymph glands or have spread elsewhere in the body, you have two primary options, primary radiation or primary surgery. However, we know that surgery allows better staging and also identification of unknown or occult metastatic disease, the lymph glands, and therefore directing the person toward additionally needed therapies, which is unknown when radiation is utilized. Radiation for smaller tumors can be equivalent to surgery, very small tumors, but larger tumors, those over 2 centimeters or so, really surgery is the best option. So,
got it.
However, non-small cell lung cancer, when you have lymph gland involvement or spread, then that becomes a disease similar to the small cell variety where systemic therapy and radiation to treat symptoms are the treatments.
Got it. You know, if we can, you know, Rod, we talk about, you know, on our show we've used the words, the four pillars of medical care, you know, those being, you know, the history, the examination, our diagnostic testing, then decision-making. You know, when someone does present, you know, they can have a variety of symptoms. It's not just clear-cut one symptom, correct? It could be a complex mishmash of things. You know, we know the whole gamut of things, that coughing in a smoker, that's a red flag, correct?
Yeah, just as a background, I'd like to plug the emergence of low-dose CT screening for lung cancer as a very important tool that we've had since 2015 or so in our armamentarium by primary care doctors primarily direct screening, just as we do breast cancer screening, colorectal screening, prostate screening for the person who is at high risk for lung cancer. And that is low-dose energy, low-dose CT X-ray, where the equivalent to go, the X-ray exposure is the same as any of us traveling from New York City to see Mark in Las Vegas. And that's about 2 X-rays worth of radiation in the upper atmosphere. So it's called low-dose screening, and it's the only study done by the NIH where a randomized group of 50,000 people in each arm, non-screeners and screeners, were done, and there was a 20% reduction in lung cancer death in those persons that were screened. It's the most important epidemiologic study related to any cancer that's been done ever. So,
wow.
And you are a person that's over 50 and has an over 20-year history of smoking, and haven't quit more than 15 years ago, you should ask your primary care doctor to allow you to have a screening, just like you would do a PSA for prostate or a lady who gets her mammograms done or your colorectal screening, just like I enjoyed yesterday in my life.
Yes.
So
wonderful.
Yeah.
You know, will insurance pay for that low-dose CT screening for our patients?
Absolutely.
So they have insurance?
Absolutely, and so they are covered by, you know, Medicare and all insurance carriers. Now, the primary negative drawback at this point in getting people screened is because it adds another thing to the primary care doctor who's seeing 50 patients in his office a day to deal with. But when you're talking about the number one killer of people in this country, cancer-wise, you need to insist upon the screening in your doctor's office, or say, hey, doc, am I a person that might be a candidate for this very simple, low-dose, non-toxic testing that can reduce the lung cancer risk more than any other cancer
wow.
in our experience?
Yeah. Yes.
Go ahead.
What's the incidence of lung cancer in non-smokers, though? Is that a factor here at all?
So if you look at the risk of cancer in non-smokers, it's about 2% in a lifetime. If you're an active smoker and meet those characteristics I described, you have about a 15% risk of lung cancer. And former smokers, about 89% risk in your lifetime of developing a lung cancer. So,
and what about family history of lung cancer?
Well, that's important, but it's much less down the ladder as far as the calculations of risk. Now, just as a resource for the listeners, you can go to many sites, you know, the Cleveland Clinic, Mayo Clinic, Memorial Sloan Kettering, MD Anderson, and also just the American Cancer Society, and look up risk calculators. There's one very easy one, and I think that I use, and that's the one by the National Cancer Institute. And it's the website is analysistools.cancer.gov, and then / lung cancer risk assessment. So I'll say that again, analysisrisk.cancer.gov / lung cancer risk assessment. And it'll tell you what your risk is over the next few years based upon your age, your ethnicity, smoking history, your asbestos exposure, something we need to talk about also, because asbestos is a very important third leading cause of lung cancer with or without smoking. So, but anyway, that's a very important tool for the people to look at with regard to calculating the risks.
Beautiful. And, you know, if we talk about different ethnic groups, which group is, in a sense, more susceptible to lung cancers? Is there, blacks more susceptible than whites, Chinese, you know?
I think it's not an issue of genetics in the sense of chromosome patterns, including, God-given melanin count. But the issue is the delivery of care in this country. We see more advanced lung cancer, breast cancer, colorectal cancer in the black and Hispanic populations than in, Caucasian ethnicities. And it's related to the later diagnosis of disease due to a lack of healthcare delivery opportunities.
Got it. And, you know, as far as then, say, the lack of the healthcare, but indeed, you know, predisposing conditions, the tobacco, as well as then possibly asbestos, what they have been through then sets them up for a problem later in life. Is that correct?
And that's all ethnicities. But again, it's if you look at the social economic issues, sort of filter scales in some different racial groups.
You know, Rod, if we talk about, say, being suspicious for a lung cancer, you know, if we're looking at the symptoms, you know, whether they're the coughing, the weight loss, the shortness of breath, spitting up blood. I mean, these are things our listeners should be aware of, correct? Are those the things that people would come into you and say, hey, you know, I lost 20 pounds, I've been coughing, I'm short of breath, I spit up some blood. Are those the things your patients talk to you about in their history?
No, most of my patients are those that are smokers, or former smokers that came in to get their inguinal hernia done, and they found a spot in their lung. Because I deal with surgery for lung cancer, so I deal, for the most part, with taking care of patients with earlier stage disease. I do take care of palliative measures when patients do come in with coughing up blood or having fluid on the lung or difficulty breathing. But those represent more advanced stages of care, and that's what we want to, again, through the surveillance issues I described, overcome. Unfortunately, half of people with lung cancer will come in with advanced disease at diagnosis, and those symptoms you described are shortness of breath, pain in the chest, you know, bleeding, coughing up blood, weight loss, and those are more advanced circumstances that we want to overcome. Just as breast cancer has resulted in a reduction in large tumors being identified with mammography, we want to screen for this disease, and we want to also quit smoking, you know, and avoid the other potential risks.
And, you know, as far as you mentioned diagnostically, you know, the low-dose CT, what other screenings do you do, or what other testing do you do? You know, is there any surgical interventions that are being done for diagnosis that you do? You know, what can people expect if they do have a presenting symptom or a problem? You know, what are the diagnostic methods here? You know, the CT scan will give you some imaging, but that doesn't give you a diagnosis, does it?
Well, no, I think that, you know, you need a tissue diagnosis is the bottom line. And the opportunities for that are a needle biopsy using a CAT scanner and or ultrasound. But more commonly, it's through bronchoscopy. And now, in this day and age, we have what's called navigational or GPS-type bronchoscopy, where the electronics and of the systems, of the bronchoscopy systems, can allow the bronchoscope to be brought in very accurately to very small lesions in the periphery of the lung. Here in our hospital, we have Dr. Sandeep Bansal, who's one of the world experts in this form of navigational bronchoscopy. The other, and so that would be our first approach, is to use bronchoscopy to try to get a tissue sample. Sometimes we need to do a primary surgical approach, which we do with video-assisted surgery or surgery like we take gallbladders out today, or look at pelvic organs, where we can go in with a camera, go in with a camera and remove the spot, and based upon it, what we find at the pathology report in the operating room, then we can move on to a proper cancer operation, or if it's benign, then you're done with it. You want to obviously avoid these interventions when possible, so it's important to grade the findings on the surveillance CT scan to either suggest observation, nothing at all, but another scan at a future date, or to move ahead with these invasive procedures, the bronchoscopy or surgery.
So that, you know, as far as if someone, let's say, we'll put this a little bit in perspective. If indeed someone did have some symptoms, went to the family doctor, said, hey, I want a low-dose CT. You find a lesion in the lung tissue. And, you know, overall, they would probably send the patient to you. And then you would do some type of a video assist bronchoscopy where you actually go in through the bronchoscope, or you would go extra thoracic to get a biopsy. How would you do that? What can our listeners expect?
I'd expect the first approach to be the bronchoscopic approach with the navigation, this very precise navigation we have today called navigational bronchoscopy. Sometimes, however, just the way the tumor looks, or the imaging, if you add PET imaging, which looks at metabolic activity of the tumor, or the size, you might we may go straight to surgery to remove the thing. But I'd say 95% of the time, we try to get a bronchoscopic or percutaneous, meaning the CT-directed biopsy, so we know what we're going into at the time of a surgery, or to avoid surgery if we find lymph glands present by bronchoscopy, et cetera. So that's the approach. And, again, what you want to be doing is forward thinking and coming in with a program, just like ladies do with their mammography, if you have a risk for lung cancer that I described with the low-dose CT screening.
And, you know, as far as, again, you know, getting patients prepared, you've said a lot of things here. And, you know, with regard to looking at the tumor, you mentioned also seeing lymph glands. You know, if there are lymph glands, and we're talking about lymph glands in the lung itself, and if one were to have lymph glands in addition to a tumor, your approach then would change to how you would treat this patient if you were able to have a tissue diagnosis, correct? You probably would not proceed with a major resection. You would probably do other therapy as chemotherapy. Is that our understanding, Rod?
Well, it depends on the nature of the glands and their location. You know, if the glands are somewhere else on the opposite side of the body, or the lung, or the chest, glands, then that precludes a surgical resection. But more and more, when we find patients with limited lymph gland involvement, we start off with a combination now of systemic chemotherapy, standard chemotherapy, plus immunotherapy. And then based upon the response to that therapy, we'll go in and remove the residual disease. And there's a recent study called the CheckMate trial, CheckMate 816. The CheckMate trial. You can find it. It was published in New England Journal in August of 2022, CheckMate trial on lung cancer. And it's the upfront or induction systemic therapy plus immunotherapy followed by resection for limited nodal burden disease. So, and that's very exciting for patients where we would not use that combination for with a significant survival advantage.
Wow.
Now,
and,
if,
you know,
go ahead. So that's called combination therapies. Sometimes surgery is not part of that combination therapy. Maybe chemotherapy, immunotherapy, maybe plus radiation, plus or minus radiation, as regionally effective management. But if disease is beyond that, like stage, metastatic disease, then
sure.
We have opportunities with systemic therapy and immunotherapy today.
As far as the words we're throwing around here, Rod, it sounds as though that lung cancer typically is very aggressive. So it is something that, we see that our patients are coming in maybe in later stages of disease development. So it's not that you have a solitary nodule, you're able to take it out surgically. Sometimes they have disease that has gone to the lymph nodes. And that's where we're talking about these very specific therapies of chemotherapy, immunotherapy, radiation, then some residual surgery. So the goal here, if at all possible, with our healthcare, is to diagnose these problems sooner than later, where it gives the patient a far better chance of life, but indeed the amount of therapy could be less. Is that a true statement?
That's a true statement. It's also a medical economically valid statement and valuable idea in that we know that early stage disease is less cost, treatment is less costly than treating of advanced stage disease.
And, at the end of the day, Rod, with, the things that we're doing, we're talking about, diagnosing it, low-dose CT scanning, with very sophisticated navigation systems and things like that. And then, of course, very sophisticated drug and probably very costly drug therapy. What about survival? What are we winning with all this? What's our survival rate today versus maybe 20 years ago? You have data like that, no doubt.
Well, yeah. Well, early stage cancer resection is about a 90% cure rate. That means small tumors that have no node involvement found at surgery. When you get planned involvement, the survivorship falls into the 50-60% range with therapies, and that would include surgery, commonly for lymph node limited disease.
Sure.
If you look at the natural history of lung cancer and survival, it's about. If you did not treat advanced stage cancer, the survival of five years is around 5%. So that's kind of
wow.
The range of things. With systemic therapy now and immunotherapy, we bring that rate up to somewhere around 15 or 20%.
Which is definitely an improvement, treatment regime, no doubt. Rod, our board is full. Mr. Mancini is just chomping at the bit to get these questions out. So if you're up for it, let me go back to the studio. Let's have Mr. Mancini start giving us some questions. And if you wouldn't mind helping us answer them, I would appreciate it. Mr. Mancini, go ahead. What do you want to start with?
Oh, yeah. What an interesting interview. And, yeah, I do got some questions. Mel coming in from Dearborn, Michigan says, in stage one lung cancer, can you experience any symptoms?
You can experience symptoms if that tumor, is near the central airway where it's occluding a central airway, and then you have a peripheral pneumonia beyond the obstruction. But and sometimes you can have bleeding from those small tumors. But it's and those are still curable. Those are curable as any other stage one lung cancer, but. But the majority, I'd have to say the majority of early cancers are found within the spongy tissue part of the lung.
And if I can, Rod, with regard, again, just I think we mentioned it, with regard to the areas of the lung that we talk about, it is the breathing tube or the airway itself that can have a cancer, which can lead to obstruction, or the spongy tissue of the lung itself can have the cancer in that tissue as well. And the symptoms are a little bit different for each location, correct?
Yeah, you may not. You may just, again, come in for your inguinal hernia repair, and the chest X-ray that they screen you with identifies a spot that's totally asymptomatic. And some people, we might say, are lucky if they have a central airway tumor that they have those symptoms of partial obstruction or some scant bleeding. Therefore, their workup begins when they have an early stage
sure.
disease.
And again, that would be a real trigger if they would come in with an airway tumor where they have had some bleeding, some airway obstruction. They may have a little bit of pneumonia. You kick it off right away. You know what the hell you need to do there. Mr.
Yeah.
Mancini, go ahead.
Yeah, Gail, from your neck of the woods where your son is down there in Fort Myers, Florida, says, nice to hear your show again, Doc. She hates to miss it. Does lung cancer ever show up in blood work? That's a great question as well.
Yeah, and you know, we talk about different blood testings. Now, from my understanding and our research, there's no specific, and Dr. Landrinoff can address it, there's no specific blood test to diagnose lung cancer. But go ahead, Rod. You can get other tests that may show the effects of the lung cancer.
Well, things are advancing, you know, There is even studies looking at animals sniffing patients and being able to differentiating aromatic polymers in there from the breath of people that have cancer versus those that not. So we may be looking to buy dogs in the future
wow.
to help us with.
But boy, that's far out.
But there's testing with microRNA and other proteins in the blood to suggest the possibility of cancer in general. With regard to lung cancer, saying, you know, if you have a lung cancer, no, there's nothing out there at this point, as you might have with looking at pancreatic cancer or ovarian cancer or germ cell line cancers. At this point, we do have blood work that gives us degrees of inflammatory proteins associated with the lung cancer and different gene patterns that will allow us to determine therapies, but not to give us a diagnosis of cancer.
And, you know, if I can, Mark, Rod,
yep.
you know, we talked about small cell cancer, non-small cell, but we talk about a tissue type. We do talk about squamous cell cancers, adenocancers of the lung. Do they give any different presentation to us overall, Rod?
You know, they all have the same potential presentation. It's just what you described as squamous cell or cells under the microscope that look like skin cells, and adenocarcinomas, which look like glandular tissue, like a pancreas or
sure.
stomach or colon. So, but the prognosis is the same for the most part in that non-small cell lung cancer and dependent totally on stage at presentation.
Got it. And hey, Rod, what we'll do when we pick this up in the next section, I want to talk about staging, okay? But go ahead, Mr. Mancini.
Yeah, let me throw one more, and then you guys can get in that. Kenneth from Peoria, Arizona, another avid listener. He wants to know, what age can you diagnose lung cancer?
You know, we see lung cancer at very young ages sometimes. By that, I mean the patients in their 30s. But they usually have a significant smoking history from a very early age, you know, pre-high school. But for the most part, smoking is a disease that occurs in patients in their 50s and beyond, with a 20-pack-year history of smoking as a history.
Very good. And, you know, as far as correlation with other tobacco products, you know, we're talking, if we use the word smoking, Rod, does that typically mean cigarette smoking? Are we encompassing cigar smoking into that as well? You know, what's the clarification on that?
Well, it's just primarily cigarette smoking. Cigar heavy cigar smokers have a risk also, but it's, you know, that's a Jackie Gleason type of situation where they're smoking all the time, you know, or,
sure.
or now, you know, again, smoking represents 90% of the writ of the population that ultimately have diagnosed with lung cancer. But, you know, a radon exposure and secondhand smoke, which is also a form of smoking, represent about 3 to 4% of all cancers in the country. And again, asbestos is a very important risk factor in the development of lung cancer with or without smoking, with the typical latency period of all these diseases around 20 years of exposure.
And Rod, who are the people that have been exposed to asbestos typically? Are we talking people in the Navy? You know, where was the asbestos coming from? Which industries?
Well, asbestos was banned in 1985 in most industrial use. But up in that time, you know, most insulation for pipe fitting, electricians, you know, construction
sure.
workers, roof. So heavy insulation is important. The also here locally, you know, we have a lot of this powdered metal development companies here in our area, and the plastic companies. So phenolic bonding, a material which was made of plastic, you know, Bakelite, if you remember that.
Yes.
That's heavily asbestos laden. About 10% of that is asbestos in that product. So, you know, plastic workers back in the 80s and early 90s. We have in the construction industry, all the abatement areas, you know, older constructions being torn down without appropriate
protection.
Here in the St. Mary's area here and DuBois, that area was just loaded with companies that were abating old places and no protection was done. That's across the country like that. But I just use – nothing's wrong with St. Mary's. It's a lovely community. But I'm just saying that we see a lot of that kind of construction work activity. You know, plumbing, insulators, petroleum workers, the dragline operators and brake mechanics, you know, have a high risk in the past.
Got it. And, you know, when we talk about that, we're talking not just a mask. These people need to have worn or need to wear some type of a respirator, correct, when they're working
correct.
Around these things?
Yes.
And, you know, as far as, just as far as with the asbestos, to talk about that, does that give us a different type of presentation than a smoker? You know, does the asbestos damage a different part of the lung or the airway, or is it conceivable it's the same damage? Go ahead.
So the two primary risks of asbestos is mesothelioma, which you see on TV advertised all the time, as far as, and that is really a rare cancer. Only about 5,000 people in the country will get that disease a year. There's asbestos caused lung cancer is 3 to 4 times more common than mesothelioma. And so, there is no differentiation with primary lung cancer. You can get all forms of lung cancer from asbestos exposure. But the other important disease that we're aware of is mesothelioma.
Got it. Yep. And, you know, as far
and
as
also,
say, Mr. Man, do you have another question, Mr. Mancini, you want to go ahead and give us? I'm not sure if he's there. You know, as far as going forward, you know, we've talked about, of course, the primary area of tumors, which could be in the airway or in the spongy parenchyma of the lung. But when someone has, you know, symptoms that have been there maybe for a while, these cancers could spread. Where are the areas that they can spread to? You know, is the bone the big one beside the lymph nodes? I know there are several other organs that lung cancer does have a predilection for in spreading, correct, using the word metastasis?
Yeah, but we see metastasis similar to other patterns, but I think the the ones that we search out closely for are the liver, the adrenal glands, the brain, and also bone. But actually, bone's further down the list than other cancers such as breast or prostate.
Why are the adrenal glands so susceptible?
I really don't know. It's just, you know, it's a homing pattern for those cells. The cells are some, you know, a safe haven for them as far as the tissues. That's where the metastatic locations are thought to have some sort of a nice harbor for these cells to live in. And different cell types of cancer have different predilections of finding harbor.
Yes. And, you know, as far as that, when someone does come in to you, do you start to set up a, you know, we talk about staging, but overall, are you looking at the bone, checking the calcium levels? Are you doing an MRI or CT of the adrenals? Do you put them through, quote, a metastatic workup? You know, what type of a workup do these people get when they come to someone like you if we're suspecting a lung cancer?
Well, the first thing is a CT scan of the chest and upper abdomen, because in that we will see the liver and the adrenal glands and the lung and the lymph glands around the windpipe, and evidence of any fluid in the lung or invasion of the chest wall. So that's the primary tool. And then from there, if we've made a diagnosis bronchoscopically or with a needle biopsy, then we do what even before that, we PET imaging, which is positron emission tomography. That's the acronym for PET. And that's a test where a radioactive sugar molecule is injected in your body, and then the sugar is utilized in the tissues of your body. We know that areas of inflammation like pneumonia and cancer have increased metabolic activity for sugar, and so the when the sugar is used, the radioactive isotope sits around for about an hour or so, and we can get a differential reading of the radioactive intensity based upon where the metabolism of that sugar was. So the PET CT, a PET scan combined with CT for localization is the next testing. There is blood testing that we do looking for inflammatory markers and different tumor markers based upon what we know will assist us in therapy direction. But the two primary issues as far as diagnosis are going to be a CT scan and a PET scan looking at the entire body for metastatic disease. And, of course, there's a functional workup. We need to make sure the heart's in good shape and that the lung function is adequate for therapy.
Wow. And, you know, if one were to see, we think, a metastatic location, does that necessarily mean it needs to be biopsied?
Not necessarily if you already have a tissue diagnosis. But, you know, if you come in with a nodule and it's suspicious and you don't yet have a tissue diagnosis, you get a PET scan and we find a site that's acting up or hot by the imaging. It may be easier to biopsy that with a needle than to do a bronchoscopy. And so it would be easier on the paper. Make a diagnosis based upon what that spot might be on PET imaging, the imaging.
Wow.
But that would, in that scene with the more advanced stages of disease. But
got it. And, Rod, you know, if we talk about the location you're seeing in now, is the level of disease more advanced? You know, is lung disease in different communities at different stages? Are there correlations to that based on socioeconomic groups, or is it something advanced disease can be in any community?
Well, there's certainly social, economic, and industrial, factors of employment and again, throughout the country that lead to hotbeds of disease or lung cancer activity. Can go on the net and just look up United States, lung cancer distribution, and you'll get a map of states and where there's with different color codes of intensity. And you find a greater area where a lot of blue collar work is being done,
yeah,
where mining is done. and where tobacco is raised and where it's part of the culture, you know. And so you'll see people intensity. Here in Pennsylvania, we're kind of in the mid zone as far as risk of lung cancer in the country.
Got it. And, you know, Rod, as far as the testings that you've talked about with the low-dose CT, you know, with navigation, are these tools that most doctors have, or are these tools that we're talking about the more sophisticated centers as Cleveland, Mayo, et cetera?
Well, I think overall it's like things have been in life and human history anywhere. There's always areas of excellence. You know, we're certainly lucky here in our hospital to have Sandeep Bansal, who's truly one of the best navigational bronchoscopists in the world. And our lab facility is second to none in the country. Second, I mean, I truly mean that it's amazing. But I would say all major centers in the country have the navigational bronchoscopists and have the radiographic capability, you know, resources to make a diagnosis, and have surgeons that can help them when needed, and excellent radiation oncologists and medical oncologists there. I don't think it's a situation where you got to travel across the country to get treated. There's excellent centers at reach throughout the country.
Beautiful. And, you know, as far as finishing up on this therapy aspect, our time is getting short. When do you operate? You know, what are the indications for surgery of the lung, taking these tumors out? You know, when do you do a segment? When do you do a lung? What are the indications here for surgery?
Well, surgery is directed toward early stage disease, just as taking out a breast tumor for early stage disease, or taking a piece of colon out, or a part of the stomach, or part of the liver. So when you have a nodule that's contained within an anatomic segment of the lung without spread to the several of the lymph glands,
yes,
or with no association of the lung being drowned with fluid, pleural effusion, then that's the indication for surgery. We've been proponents and championed in the literature and through our writing to do lesser lung resections for smaller tumors. So we would do a segmentectomy for a tumor, let's say the size of a nickel, whereas one the size of a silver dollar, we're going to have to take a larger portion of the lung. But the critical issue that we do a very systematic lymph gland staging to make sure that there isn't advanced occult disease, and also that we have taken the entire tumor out, that we're not cutting across tumor with the degree of surgery we choose. So a segmentectomy, which is a lung-sparing approach done by video-assisted surgery that we discussed earlier, like for gallbladders or
yes,
pelvic. We do that in the chest. We can minimize the trauma of surgery with that, and also reduce the amount of lung tissue loss with an anatomic less than lobectomy resection. Lobectomy is the standard of care for, meaning taking a half or a third of the lung for larger tumors. On occasion, we have to take the entire lung out. That's called a pneumonectomy, but that's much less commonly needed.
And, you know, as far as being able to function in life, can you take one lung out and still live pretty effectively without oxygen, et cetera? You know, how much of a lung can you take out that people can still function well, Rod?
Well, you know, before an operation called a pneumonectomy, taking one lung out, we have to do a pretty extensive, you know, functional study, such as lung function tests and cardiac testing, to assure that the trauma of that surgery and the postoperative life of the patient is reasonable. But you can live with one lung very adequately if you use the physiologic parameters. We like to remove as least amount of lung as possible, yet do a good cancer operation. So therefore, you know, when appropriate segmentectomy, where there's really no loss of functional lung tissue, is it would be preferred. Lobectomy is most commonly done, and then but people do quite well after a lobectomy if their lung function is reasonable.
And, you know, if someone does have, say, a lobectomy, what does their hospital stay consist of? Are they in the hospital for several days or longer than that? You know, and then do they go into rehab, Rod? What's kind of the post-operative course?
Well, if a person has lung function going into lung surgery and has not been smoking and the risk of a post-operative pneumonia has been reduced, their hospital stay is usually 3 or 4 days. The limiting factor on the length of the hospitalization is primarily the chest tube that's placed after the surgery to enhance lung expansion and to remove any fluid that tends to accumulate it from the surgical procedure. So it's about a 3 or 4 day hospitalization. If you come in with lung function that's not the greatest, you may need to be in rehab or either home rehab or some hospital visit. Physical therapy, and some people that have issues or complications after surgery may have to go into an extended care facility. That's why we emphasize so heavily the cessation of smoking to reduce postoperative complication.
Very good. And, you know, could you summarize the staging of lung cancer for us, you know, and put it together?
Yeah.
As what are the staging guidelines here?
It's just with other tumors, there's a universal code that's used. It's called T, standing for tumor, N, standing for nodes, and M, standing for metastasis, or the TNM classification. That goes for head and neck cancers like you take care of, GYN cancers, to lung cancer, et cetera. Stage one, and it goes into a 1 through 4 category, stage one being the earliest cancer, and stage four meaning advanced cancer. Stage one cancer is a tumor confined to a lung without lymph node involvement. Stage two cancer is disease confined to a lung and with some lymph glands within the lung tissue. Stage three cancer is disease confined to a lung with lymph glands that have now spread to the middle, like the tracheal area of the respiratory tract. And stage four represents disease that's spread outside of the lung to other parts of the body. And that really parallels easily.
Yes. And, you know, thank you. Very excellent way of putting that all together. And, you know, our listeners, should they need to know this from their doctor? Are these things they could go in and ask if they're found to have cancer? The doctor would tell them what stage they're in, no doubt, correct?
Well, I think it begins first with the radiologist giving a clue clinically, and then the pathologist if you've got a tissue diagnosis. And then finally, your therapist, being a radiation oncologist, a medical oncologist or your thoracic surgeon, and also your family doctor, they're very well versed in this also. They can use the information provided to them by these specialists, the radiologist, the pathologist, and the therapist, and give you a good idea of where your cancer is.
Beautiful. And, you know, career, what are you working on now? I understand you're writing a chapter.
Well, I'm always writing something, and you know, I'm a clinical scientist in addition to a surgeon, our ongoing investigation is the I decide when less than lobectomy can be utilized for early stage cancer versus the need for lobectomy, and so that's been kind of the focus of my life, as the University of Pittsburgh breast cancer surgeons have done since the 1960s, avoiding radical mastectomy, and now where we are, where only partial resections of the breast and radiation and chemotherapy are the primary goal, as opposed to the surgery of the 60s, where very mutilating surgery was done on ladies.
Sure. And, you know, as far as working on that, is that an article you're getting ready for publication somewhere?
We have three of them in process. We just had an article in February in the New England Journal of Medicine looking at this concept of lesser resection for early stage cancer.
Beautiful. And, you know, I understand your career maybe is changing. You're relocating down in Tampa, Florida. Do you want to talk about that?
About a month ago, one of my residents from the University of Pittsburgh asked me to join him at Tampa General Hospital. His name is Dr. Eric Summers. He's an outstanding thoracic surgeon with the Tampa General Cancer Institute, and he's asked me to join him and his team at the University of South Florida and at Tampa General Hospital's Cancer Institute to help with lung and esophageal cancer.
And what kind of duties will you have there, Rod?
Well, I'll be there next month. Actually, I'm getting in the car on Monday, so I'll be there pretty soon. And my duties will be clinical and clinical outcome research through the Tampa General Cancer Institute.
And will that be a larger population than what you're working on now?
You know, Greg, in our area, this is the largest rural community in the country. We all these little hamlets, as you know, in central Pennsylvania. It's half a million. We represent, what, a half a million people or so, whereas the Tampa, north central Florida is, you know, just growing. It's just growing 5-10% per year, and it's in the millions. So,
wow.
I'm looking forward to that opportunity. You know, I grew up in Louisiana, so getting back south in that heat and humidity,
sure.
I guess I'll have to re-accommodate to that.
Got it. Would like you to be a friend of the show down in Tampa as well, if you do that for us.
Yeah, it'd be great.
I'd love to hear from you. And Mr. Mancini, do you want to go ahead? We'll wrap this up.
Let me take one more question, and then we can wrap it up with about 3 minutes to go. Albert from Poway, California says, listen to the show, keeps getting knowledge each and every week. Keep up the great work, Doc. He said, is there an easy way to detect lung cancer?
I mentioned that, you know, there's going to be, I think, in the future, blood diagnosis in the future. And also, again, maybe we can find a right breed of dog to help us out in our clinics, Greg. But the present time, the best way of identifying early treatable cancer is with this very safe low-dose CT screening for patients at risk, persons at risk. And now those are people over the age of 50 who have a 20-year history of smoking. And with that, we can reduce lung cancer mortality by 20%.
Great
job.
And,
you know, you have another one you want to take, Mark, real quick?
One more thing.
I got a quick one if we can. Steve from Corvallis, Oregon, basically says, is there a way of knowing you have lung cancer? I guess that's his question coming out of Corvallis.
Yeah.
I think you need to work up.
I don't think there's any easy way to do it, but again, it's going through, you know, our four pillars, history, exam, diagnostic testing, and then decision-making.
Yep.
He needs to listen to the show again. We have a lot of tips there. And, you know, Dr. Landernow, how can people get a hold of you? Can you give us that website again to talk about calculating cancer risk?
Yeah, it's through the National Cancer Institute, and it's the HTTPS thing, and it's then analysistools.cancer.gov/lung cancer risk assessment.
Beautiful. And I'd like to tell our listeners, Mr. Mancini, if you don't mind, next week we're going to talk about breast cancer. And again, we had a great discussion today. Our goal now, we've had several specialists on talking about cancer. As we get through the end of this, we are going to have possibly some roundtable discussions with many specialists talking about different screenings, different therapies, different commonalities about cancer, giving a summary to what we've been doing. So we'll keep you posted, Mr. Mancini.
Oh, that's going to be good. Let everybody know how they can get a hold of you at your great offices out there in Pittsburgh, Doc.
Mine is GJRMD 308 at Outlook.com. And what about Dr. Landrenau? How can I get a hold of you, Dr. Landrenau?
Well, I'm in transition with my business email. I can be found through Tampa General Hospital in the next 3 weeks or so in Tampa, Florida. But my private email is landrenaurj@gmail.com, and that's LandrenaurJ@gmail.
Wow.
Wonderful.
What a great show,
boys.
You want
to close it off, Mr. Mancini?
Yeah, and as we wind this thing down, you've listened to Doc Talk Podcast, hosted by a brother, a mentor, and a friend out there in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Dr. Greg Roscoe. Dr. Rodney Landrenau is out there, too, making his transition into Tampa. Yours truly, Mark Mancini in Los Angeles, producing this great show. We'll see you next week talking about breast cancer, and that'll be another good one, Kelly Smith. Till then, have a blessed one. Check out the archive on blogtalkradio.com/Mancini Sports, and have a safe weekend.
Thank you very much.